For decades, the American dream was basically this one-way highway pointing straight south.
Oh, absolutely.
Like you hit a certain age or, maybe you hit a certain tax bracket and you just packed up, moved to the Florida Peninsula, sheltered your income, and I mean, you hit the beach.
Right. It was the ultimate predictable financial play and a lifestyle play, really.
Exactly. But if you look at the migration data and just all the real estate chatter right now, there is this highly calculated, mathematically driven, it's basically a mass exodus heading in the exact opposite direction.
Yeah, people are fleeing the Sun Belt.
They really are. And the destination isn't, what you'd expect.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what we're going to get into today.
It's a complete inversion of the traditional relocation map. I mean, we're watching a demographic that historically prioritized warm weather and low taxes suddenly prioritize entirely different, vastly more urgent metrics.
Which is what makes our source material for this deep dive so incredibly compelling. For those of you listening, we are unpacking a highly specific, very granular 2026 relocation guide.
It's a fascinating document.
It really is. It's authored by Gennaro Schaffer, who is a licensed broker operating out of Bellingham, Washington, under Bellwether Real Estate. And usually, when you read a relocation guide from a broker, it's essentially just a glossy travel brochure.
Right. Lots of sunset photos and fluff.
Yeah, exactly. Sunset photos, vague promises about like community, and just generic marketing copy designed to get you to call them.
But this document is a strictly numbers-driven, pragmatic analysis. I mean, Schaefer has documented the exact math, the climate trade-offs, and frankly, the sheer logistical friction of trading the state of Florida for the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
It's a localized forensic look at a macro trend.
And what immediately jumped out at me, and I think you'll agree, is how this guide just completely flips the script on why people are moving.
Oh, entirely.
Because the assumption is usually that someone moving from Miami to a place like Bellingham is either chasing some remote work fantasy, they want to sip artisan coffee in the mountains and wear flannel all day.
The romanticized cabin in the woods idea.
Right. Or alternatively, they're trying to exploit some obscure tax loophole.
Wow.
But Schaffer lays it out so clearly. This is no longer a tax play. It is fundamentally an insurance and climate play.
And that framing is critical for anyone listening to this deep dive who might be, caught in this current housing market reality. We really have to separate the romanticized vacation-style idea of the Pacific Northwest from the day-to-day grounded reality.
Because the day-to-day is where it actually matters.
Exactly. We need to look at the equity transfers, the weather shocks, the cultural adjustments, because making a cross-country move based on a fantasy is, well, it's how you end up financially ruined.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start right there. Let's start with the money.
Always a good place to start.
Because if you tell people at a dinner party that you are leaving Florida for the West Coast, the immediate reaction is always, oh, man, you're going to lose your shirt in taxes.
Right.
And we really need to put a stake through the heart of that assumption immediately.
Yeah, that tax myth is just it's pervasive, but it relies on really outdated maps of the American economy. I think people just conflate Washington State with California.
Exactly. They hear West Coast and immediately think, like, California income tax rates. But here is a reality check straight from the guide. Florida has a 0% state income tax.
Right.
And Washington State also has a 0% state income tax.
Exactly, zero.
Moving from Tampa or Orlando to Bellingham saves you or costs you exactly $0 on your W-2. The broker even notes that any relocation service telling you otherwise is basically just recycling a script meant for people fleeing Los Angeles or San Francisco.
Yeah, it completely clears the board. I mean, if you are coming from Florida expecting to suddenly discover a hidden vault of income tax savings,
or if you're terrified of a massive new tax burden.
Right. Either way, you are fundamentally misunderstanding the playing field. The income tax equation is just a total wash.
Okay, so if income tax is a wash, my mind immediately jumps to the next massive line item for any homeowner, which is property taxes.
Naturally.
Because, local governments have to fund their roads and schools somehow. So if Washington isn't taxing your income, do they just absolutely hammer you on the assessed value of your home?
You'd logically assume that, right? But the data tells a really different story. If we look at the effective property tax rates, Florida sits around 0.74% to 0.82% statewide.
Okay.
Now let's look at Whatcom County, which is where Bellingham is located.
Yeah.
The median effective rate there is roughly 7.74%.
Wait, if the countywide rate is 0.74%, that's virtually identical to Florida.
It is.
But surely inside the actual city limits, you know, where the infrastructure is denser, it has to spike.
Well, it creeps up, but I think spike is too strong a word here. Inside the actual Bellingham city limits, once you add in like local levies for schools, parks, municipal services, you're looking at about 0.90% to 0.92%.
Okay, I have to push back on that being a wash, though.
Oh, really? Why?
Because if we're talking about a $675,000 house in Bellingham versus a $400,000 house in Florida, that 0.90% is being applied to a much larger principal.
That's true.
So that's a significantly larger check you have to write to the county every single year. Doesn't that immediately put the Florida transplant in the red?
On the raw property tax bill alone, yes, absolutely. You will pay more gross dollars in property tax simply because the asset itself is more expensive.
Right.
But the guide is very blunt about why this isolated metric doesn't really matter in the grand scheme. Buyers who arrive in Bellingham obsessing over a slight bump in their property tax bill are completely missing the financial black hole that they just escaped from.
And here's where we hit the absolute core of this deep dive.
Yep.
Because the financial driver isn't taxes.
Not at all.
It's the insurance reality.
This is the fulcrum. This is the entire point upon which this relocation trend balances.
So looking at the 2026 data in the guide, Florida has cemented its status as the most expensive state in the entire country for home insurance.
By a wide margin.
The average annual premium has reached a staggering $7,562.
Yeah, over $7,500.
Just to insure the structure against wind and peril. Now, flip the country. The statewide average in Washington is roughly $1,533 a year.
We really need to pause and dissect that math for a second, because that is a $6,000 a year swing in post-tax liability.
That is not a rounding error. That is life-altering money. I mean, think about what that actually means on a monthly basis for you. That $6,000 annual savings is basically the equivalent of finding a secret $500 a month dividend just for changing your geographic coordinates.
Exactly.
It's not a one-time credit you negotiate at the closing table. It is recurring year-after-year financial relief.
And to understand the true impact, you know, you have to project that out.
Right.
Over 10 years of ownership, assuming those rates remain perfectly flat, which, historically speaking, is incredibly generous.
Oh, yeah, they never stay flat. Florida premiums have consistently climbed at a much steeper, vastly more violent trajectory than Washington's.
Exactly. But even if they stayed flat, you are looking at $60,000 kept in your pocket. $60,000 purely in insurance arbitrage.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
But explain why this gap exists and why it's widening. Because why is an average three-bedroom house in Florida costing $7,000 to insure, while a house in the Pacific Northwest costs a fraction of that? It can't just be greedy insurance companies, right?
No, it's not. It's a cascading failure of risk modeling.
Okay.
The guide points to the broader context of the Florida insurance market over the last few years. You have major, national, well-capitalized insurance carriers literally withdrawing from the state.
Just pulling up stakes entirely.
Entirely. Because they ran the climate models, they looked at the frequency and severity of the storms, factored in the skyrocketing costs of building materials and labor to replace roofs, and they basically decided the state was simply uninsurable at a price point that consumers could actually pay.
Right. And when the private market flees, everyone just gets dumped into Citizens, right?
Exactly. Citizens Property Insurance is the state-backed insurer of last resort.
Which means the taxpayers are backing it.
Right. But it has swelled into this bloated behemoth, taking on hundreds of thousands of policies because the private market just collapsed under the weight of climate risk and, frankly, a historically rampant culture of roofing litigation in Florida.
Oh, the roofing scams. Yeah.
It's huge. And because Citizens has to purchase its own reinsurance, which is basically insurance for insurance companies, bought on the global market, those massive costs are passed directly down to the homeowner. Hence, these $7,500 premiums.
Wow. And the guide explicitly details how this single line item is quietly and really ruthlessly forcing retirees on fixed incomes to just abandon the state entirely.
It's sad, really.
It is. It's not that they suddenly hate the beach or the golf courses. It's that they are being mathematically evicted by their escrow accounts.
Right.
I mean, the sheer anxiety of opening your mail every November to see if your carrier dropped you or if they doubled your rate, it just sounds exhausting.
It is the definition of an unsustainable cost of living. It shifts home ownership from an asset building exercise into a defensive holding action.
Wow, a defensive holding action. That's a great way to put
it. But as crucial as that insurance savings is, it brings us to a massive secondary hurdle here.
Right, the equity transfer.
Exactly. Knowing you can save $6,000 a year is fantastic, obviously. But that only helps you if you can actually afford to get your foot in the door of the Bellingham real estate market in the first place.
Yeah. Can your Florida house actually buy a Bellingham house? We know the carrying costs are vastly superior, but let's look at the sticker price reality in 2026.
Let's do the math.
The data shows Bellingham's median single-family home sits somewhere between $645,000 and $700,000. For our math today, the broker uses $675,000 as the working average.
Okay.
And he assumes closing costs are around 1.5%, which is roughly $10,000.
So $675,000 is the target you have to hit. Now we have to look at the ammunition the buyer is bringing, which is what sellers are actually netting in Florida after you take out the roughly 7% in standard closing and agent costs.
The source breaks this down city by city. And honestly, it is a fascinating look at the splintered reality of the Florida market.
It really is. The disparity is wild.
Let's start down south. A Miami seller right now nets about $606,000.
Okay.
Tampa, they're netting around $412,000. Orlando sits at roughly $381,000. And Jacksonville is netting about $279,000.
We really have to analyze those gaps because they dictate entirely different relocation strategies.
Right.
So for a Miami seller, this transition is relatively frictionless. If they net $606,000, they are well within striking distance of that $675,000 Bellingham median.
They're right there?
Yeah. They could put down a massive 25% down payment, which is around $170,000 secure, a great interest rate, and still have over $400,000 in liquid reserves. Or they could comfortably buy into the $550,000 to $625,000 tier with cash and essentially eliminate their housing cost entirely.
But, I mean, the Miami market is an outlier, right? Driven by international cash and just immense wealth density. What about the rest of the state?
This is where it gets tricky.
Because if we look at someone coming from Tampa, they are netting $412,000. If the Bellingham median is $675,000, that Tampa seller is facing a gap of roughly $263,000 just to hit the median.
That's a huge gap.
It sounds a lot like getting priced out. And an Orlando or Jacksonville seller is in an even deeper hole. So how does this broker claim this move makes financial sense for them?
Well, on the surface, you are absolutely right. It looks like a massive downgrade in purchasing power. But this is exactly where that insurance math from our earlier discussion acts as a kind of financial superpower.
Okay, walk me through that.
The broker lays out a crucial counterintuitive formula here. Saving $6,000 a year in insurance is the mathematical equivalent of carrying roughly $90,000 to $110,000 less mortgage debt at current interest rates.
Wait, hold on. Let me make sure I'm fully mapping this out.
Go for it.
Because you aren't paying that $500 a month to a Florida insurance company money that basically just vanishes into the ether.
Right.
You can take that exact same $500 and apply it to a larger mortgage principal in Washington. And your actual out-of-pocket monthly burn rate doesn't change by a single cent.
Precisely. You are shifting capital from an unrecoverable expense, the insurance, into an equity building asset.
Wow.
When you factor in the significantly lower carrying costs, a Florida buyer who looks at the Bellingham sticker price and feels priced up is actually often cash flow even, or sometimes even ahead on a monthly basis.
That's wild.
The sticker price is higher, yes, but the cost to operate the home is so much lower that it just absorbs the difference in the mortgage payment.
I mean, that is a total paradigm shift for anyone browsing Zillow right now.
Yeah.
It means you can't just look at a $675,000 price tag in Washington, look at your $450,000 Florida home, and assume you are priced out.
You really have to run the total operational math.
But even if the monthly math works, there are severe immediate hurdles to actually executing this move.
Logistics.
Exactly. The physical act of getting your life across the continent isn't cheap.
No, the hidden costs of moving and exiting are substantial, and they must be subtracted directly from your initial equity. We aren't talking about a weekend trip with a rented U-Haul here.
Definitely not.
A full-service, white-glove interstate move from Florida to Washington will run between $9,000 and $24,000, depending on your origin city and just the sheer weight of your household goods.
Because Miami to Bellingham is roughly 3,300 driving miles.
It's massive.
It's practically the longest diagonal line you can draw across the lower 48 states.
Exactly. Even if you try to, hack the system and use container services like PODS, where you pack it yourself and they just handle the freight, you are still looking at a bill of $4,500 to $10,000.
Just for the boxes.
Right. And if you are shipping a vehicle rather than driving it across the country yourself, add another $1,200 to $1,900 per car.
Oh, man. And there is one other very specific insidious cost mentioned in the guide regarding Washington real estate. We talked about how there's no state income tax, but the state still gets its pound of flesh, right?
Oh, they always do.
When you eventually go to sell that Bellingham house down the road, Washington hits you with a real estate excise tax, or REIT.
Yes. This is a critical detail for long-term financial planning that Florida buyers often just completely miss.
Because they're not used to it.
Right. Think of REIT as a toll booth positioned at the exit of the state rather than at the entrance. The REIT is a graduated tax that sellers pay in Washington, and it ranges from 1.1% up to 3.0% of the total sale price of the home, depending on the final value.
So let me get this straight. If I sell a house in Florida, I pay a documentary stamp tax, which is pretty nominal, right?
Nominal.
But in Washington, if I sell a $1 million home eventually, I'm writing a check to the state for tens of thousands of dollars just for the privilege of selling my own property.
Correct. Washington doesn't tax your labor while you live there, but they heavily tax the exit of your real estate capital.
Wow.
It doesn't affect your ability to enter the Bellingham market today, obviously, but if you are planning to treat this home as a short-term flip or a five-year stepping stone, that exit tax fundamentally alters your return on investment.
Okay, so we've run the gauntlet on the mortgage, the moving trucks, and the exit taxes, but what about the daily ledger?
The cost of existing.
Yeah, because the cost of living isn't just your mortgage payment and your insurance, it's the credit card bill. It's groceries. It's putting gas in your car. And what I found so compelling about this deep dive is how it highlights that your daily cost of living is heavily, inextricably dictated by your local environment.
Yes, the concept of environmental economics is a fascinating lens through which to view relocation. It's basically the idea that your geography dictates your consumption.
Let's look at the line-by-line cost of living differences. What inherently goes up when you transition to the Pacific Northwest?
Well, the pump shock is real.
Oh, the gas prices.
Yeah, the guide notes that gas in Washington is drastically higher. We are talking $3.85 to $4.20 a gallon, compared to Florida's $2.75 to $3.20.
And why is that? Because, again, without an income tax, Washington heavily taxes fuel to fund its highway infrastructure.
Exactly.
You will absolutely feel that every time you fill up. Though I will say, the broker provides a small caveat that you'll likely be driving far fewer miles in Bellingham because the geography is more compact than the sprawling Florida interstates.
That's a fair point. But then you have the sales tax, which is another daily increase. Bellingham's combined municipal and state sales tax rate sits around 8.8%, whereas Florida averages around 7%, depending on the county. Groceries are roughly a wash. Both regions run near or slightly above the national average, largely due to supply chain logistics, though specialty or imported items might carry a premium up in Washington.
And what about dining out? Because Florida has a massive service industry.
Dining out, specifically at mid-tier restaurants, is noticeably pricier in Washington.
Really?
Yes. And this is a direct result of labor laws. Washington has a significantly higher minimum wage than Florida, and importantly, Washington does not have a tipped minimum wage loophole.
Oh, wait, so servers get the full minimum wage plus tips.
Exactly. A server in Bellingham makes the full state minimum wage before a single tip is left on the table. So that labor cost is baked into the price of your burger and your craft beer.
Okay, so your gas, your sales tax, and your Friday night dinner all go up. That sounds like a slow bleed on the wallet.
It does.
But then we get to what goes down, and this is what the guide brilliantly terms the climate dividend.
I love that phrase.
Right. This is where the environmental economics heavily favor the Pacific Northwest. First and foremost, cooling costs.
Consider the brute force energy consumption of a standard Florida home. You are running a massive central air conditioning unit essentially year-round.
247, pretty
right. It is constantly fighting a losing battle against 90-degree heat and 80% humidity. The summer electric bills are staggering capital drains.
But in Bellingham, the guide states that a vast majority of homes don't even have central air conditioning.
It's true.
That sounds insane to a Floridian. How do you survive?
Hmm.
But the reality is, you might use an energy-efficient heat pump or literally just snap a small window unit into your bedroom for the 1 or 2 weeks in August when it actually gets uncomfortably warm.
Yeah, otherwise you just open the windows, your annual cooling spend practically drops to zero.
And then we have to discuss the capital expenditure of merely existing in a disaster zone.
This is huge.
The guide outlines these eliminated recurring costs, and I swear it reads like a hostage release form for Florida homeowners.
It really does.
Yes. Because you are no longer saving up $30,000 to retrofit your house with impact windows.
Right.
You aren't being forced to re-roof your house every 10 years purely because the insurance company threatens to drop you, regardless of whether the roof actually leaks or not.
And you aren't driving to Home Depot in an absolute panic to buy overpriced plywood at the last minute.
Yes. You aren't paying for evacuation hotels, gas hoarding, or boarding up your property.
These aren't just inconveniences, you know. They are massive, unplannable capital outlays. The environment in Florida actively demands tribute.
Demands tribute. That is perfectly said.
And that leads to a profound point made in the text about the emotional toll, what the broker calls the lifestyle contraction happening in the Sun Belt.
Yeah, you read this section of the guide and the exhaustion just radiates off the page. People moved to Florida to live a very specific dream.
They did.
They moved for the boat docked out back, the year-round golf, the lanai, the beach days. But the climate reality of 2026 is that the environment has become hostile to that dream. The heat index literally forces people into hermetically sealed air-conditioned boxes from June all the way through October.
The physical reality of the summer is brutal now. Highs sitting in the low to mid-90s with 70 to 90% humidity. I mean, when a 93-degree afternoon feels like 105 degrees, you aren't playing golf.
No.
You aren't sitting on the patio sipping a drink. The lifestyle you literally moved across the country for, the lifestyle you are paying a huge premium for, has contracted into the few hours after sunset.
And when we talk about the emotional toll, we have to look at the hurricane data provided in the text. This isn't abstract fear. It's documented historical trauma for these people.
It's devastating.
The text cites Hurricane Ian in 2022, which caused over $112 billion in damage. Then the relentless back-to-back psychological blows of Helene and Milton in 2024, with Milton alone causing $34 billion in damage and spawning completely unpredictable, record-breaking tornadoes.
The broker frames it perfectly. These are no longer once-in-a-generation anomalies.
Right.
They are a recurring, expected line item on the calendar. The psychological grind of watching the cone of uncertainty, of watching the weather channel for a week straight, the prep, the existential dread, dealing with the aftermath and the insurance adjusters, it is a massive, hidden lifestyle cost that drains your baseline energy and your wallet.
Which perfectly sets up the payoff of Bellingham.
Yeah.
It's not just that you are avoiding the catastrophic storms, it's about reclaiming your daily life.
Yes.
Bellingham offers summer highs averaging around 72 degrees with practically zero humidity. Because of how far north it is, it stays light out until 9 or even 10 p.m. in the peak of summer. You can finish work, hike a Galbraith Mountain, paddle the bay, and actually exist in the outdoors. You are trading a fundamentally hostile environment for an accommodating one.
It sounds idyllic. It sounds like the perfect escape hatch, right?
It does.
But any seasoned observer of real estate knows that every geography demands a toll. There is no perfect place.
Exactly. If Florida's toll is the crushing heat, the catastrophic hurricanes, and the insurance crisis, what is Bellingham's toll? Because you don't get 72-degree summers and stunning mountain views for free.
No, you don't.
Which brings us to the most candid part of the guide. The honest catch. I have to say, the broker doesn't sugarcoat this at all.
Transparency here is crucial because this is where the fantasy shatters for many transplants. The catch is the winter.
The gray winter.
And it is vital to understand that it's not the physical temperature that is the primary challenge. It is the atmospheric reality. It is the light, or rather, the profound lack thereof.
The guide spells it out with brutal clarity. From roughly November through February, Bellingham is shrouded in gray. We are talking about roughly 230 cloudy or mostly cloudy days a year.
230?
Yeah. They only get about 155 to 175 genuinely sunny days. Now, the rain isn't what a Floridian pictures when they hear the word rain. It's not a violent street flooding downpour that clears up in an hour.
Right. It's not a thunderstorm.
It's described as a light, cool, persistent atmospheric drizzle spread out over 9 or 10 months. The temperatures aren't even that brutal, mostly hovering in the high 20s to high 40s, and actual accumulating snow in the city limits is quite rare.
But the physiological and psychological shift caused by that prolonged grayness cannot be overstated. I mean, the human body, especially one acclimated to subtropical sunshine, reacts severely to light deprivation.
I can imagine.
Going an entire week or sometimes 2 weeks in December without seeing a single clear patch of blue sky is a jarring, highly disorienting transition.
It's biological. The guide explicitly mentions that seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, is a legitimate clinical reality in the Pacific Northwest.
It is. A rigorous vitamin D regimen and the daily use of a Hylux daylight lamp aren't just quirky local suggestions. They are standard issue, necessary tools for maintaining your baseline mental health during the winter.
Let me try to put this into an analogy. Moving from Florida to Washington is like trading a dramatic summer blockbuster movie, you know, incredible CGI, massive explosions, high stakes, intense thunderstorms, brutal heat for a really long, slow burn, moody indie film.
I like that.
The indie film is beautiful. It's thoughtful. It won awards at Sundance, but it requires a totally different kind of endurance. You have to be okay with sitting in the quiet and the gray.
That in a highly accurate comparison. It requires a fundamental rewiring of your psychological endurance. And because the broker knows this, because he has seen people make this move and instantly regret it, he insists on a specific, non-negotiable litmus test for prospective buyers.
I love this part. The absolute recommendation is do not, under any circumstances, list your Florida home until you have visited Bellingham in November or January.
Yes.
Do not go on a scouting trip in July, because as he rightly points out, summer up there sells itself. Anyone with a pulse will fall in love with a 72-degree sunny day looking out at the San Juan Islands.
Oh, of course. The true test of geographic compatibility is whether you can walk around the historic Fairhaven District in a 45-degree bone-chilling drizzle at 3 p.m. when the light is already fading, duck into a local cafe, and still feel a sense of peace, coziness, and belonging.
The source material shares this incredibly illustrative, almost haunting anecdote to drive this home.
It's a great story.
The broker talks about taking two different Florida buyers on that exact winter walk. The first buyer sits down in that cozy cafe, looks out at the gray bay, and texts the broker saying, "This is it. This is exactly what I want. I love the mood."
Right.
And the other buyer, dead silence on the entire 90-minute drive back down Interstate 5 to the airport at SeaTac. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to say a single word. They knew instantly in their bones they couldn't handle the gray. You have to find out which one of those people you are before you pack your entire life into a moving truck.
It is the ultimate reality check. It forces the buyer to confront the geography on its worst day, not its best. But let's assume you pass that test. You sit in the cafe in January, you watch the drizzle, and you feel that sense of profound relief. You are ready to pull the trigger.
Okay.
Now you face the staggering logistical mountain of actually executing the transition. How do you pull off a cross-country real estate transaction without flying back and forth six times, bleeding money on hotels, and disrupting your entire career?
Right. And this is where the modern era provides a massive cheat code. The guide points out that Bellingham is practically custom-built for remote or semi-remote workers who are migrating from the East Coast.
Oh, it's perfect for them.
The time zone differential is the ultimate lifestyle hack here.
The mechanics of it are fascinating. Florida is entirely on Eastern time. Bellingham is on Pacific time. That is a permanent structural 3-hour gap.
So if you manage to keep your 9-to-5 Eastern time job, say you work for a firm based in Miami or New York, your actual working hours sitting at your desk in Bellingham are 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. Pacific time. Now, my immediate pushback when I read that is waking up at 5:30 a.m. every single day, especially in the pitch black, freezing December mornings we just talked about, really worth it?
Well,
that sounds like a fast track to burnout.
It requires immense discipline, certainly. You are essentially living in two different temporal realities.
Yeah.
But consider the lifestyle dividend you gain in exchange. By logging off exactly at 2.00 p.m. local time, you unlock the entire afternoon.
That's true.
You have glorious, long, dry, 72-degree summer afternoons to go mountain biking on the world-class trails of Wellbraith or paddleboarding on Bellingham Bay, while the rest of the West Coast is still stuck in Zoom meetings for another 3 hours. It is a schedule that perfectly complements and honestly subsidizes the outdoor lifestyle that draws people to the Pacific Northwest in the first place.
That makes total sense. You are basically weaponizing the time zones to buy back your daylight.
Exactly.
But the guide is also incredible. Clear, almost issuing a stern warning for folks who are not remote workers. If you are a teacher, a nurse, or a retail manager, and you need a local job in Bellingham, you have to be very clear-eyed about the macroeconomic reality of the region.
Yes. Bellingham is a regional hub, but it is not a sprawling, hyper-capitalized corporate metropolis like Miami or Orlando.
Right.
The local economy leans heavily on a few specific pillars. There's healthcare, with Peace Health being the dominant employer. There's higher education anchored by Western Washington University. And then a mix of retail, maritime trades, and local services.
And because it's not a corporate banking hub, the salaries reflect that. The guide explicitly warns that local wages experience severe compression compared to South Florida.
They do.
So, while the cost of living and insurance savings are substantial, as we've discussed, they may not entirely bridge a massive salary gap if you are moving from a highly compensated professional role in Tampa to a similar local role in Whatcom County. You might save $6,000 on insurance, but if you take a $15,000 pay cut to work locally, the math starts moving backwards.
It demands rigorous spreadsheet work before you commit.
For sure.
Now, assuming the job math works out, there is another logistical tether to consider: family. If you are moving to Washington, but your aging parents or extended family are all still back in Florida, how brutal is the aviation logistics?
Yeah.
Because you can't just drive over for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, the map is not your friend here. Bellingham does have its own airport, Bellingham International, or BLI. And the guide says it's a fantastic, easy, low-stress regional airport.
It is.
But it is primarily useful for trips down the coast.
Yeah.
You can fly direct to Las Vegas, Phoenix, or Oakland. But there are absolutely zero nonstop flights to anywhere in Florida.
Which means you are entirely reliant on SeaTac Seattle-Tacoma International Airport.
And SeaTac is not exactly around the corner. It is roughly 90 miles south of Bellingham.
Depending on traffic.
Right. Depending on traffic through Seattle, which can be nightmarish.
Yeah.
That translates to a 1.5 to 2-hour drive down Interstate 5 just to get to your terminal.
Yeah.
From there, you do have direct 5.5-hour flights to Miami, Orlando, Tampa, and Fort Lauderdale. But the broker makes it very clear. Visiting Florida is manageable maybe once or twice a year, but it is a genuine, exhausting all-day commute to make it happen.
It solidifies the permanence of the move. It is not a casual snowbird commute.
No.
So we've sorted the income. We understand the flights. How on earth do you actually secure the asset? The guide outlines this sight unseen buying playbook that is truly remarkable. People are regularly wiring $675,000 to purchase homes they have barely or never physically stepped inside.
It blew my mind. Mm. But the remote buyer workflow has become this highly formalized, almost militaristic operation. It doesn't start with aimlessly browsing Zillow. It begins with an intense 30-minute video prep call with the broker to map out hard budgets, lifestyle deal breakers, and architectural preferences. From there, the buyer receives highly filtered, real-time alerts directly from the Northwest Multiple Listing Service, or NWMLS.
And it is worth noting that the NWMLS operates with a very different cadence and data structure than the regional MLS systems in Florida, often providing much deeper historical data on the properties.
That's helpful.
But the truly wild part of the methodology is the FaceTime walkthroughs.
Yes. The broker isn't just walking through the front door and showing them the stainless steel appliances and the crown molding. That's useless.
Right.
He is acting as a proxy for their physical senses. He is literally climbing into dirt crawl spaces with his phone flashlight pointing out attic ventilation and checking the slope of the driveway. But my absolute favorite part is that he narrates the vibe of the block.
The vibe check.
Yes. He'll go out at 6 p.m. on a Tuesday, point the camera down the street and say, okay, here's the noise level. Here's what the neighbor's yards look like. He's trying to digitally transmit the intangible culture of the neighborhood.
It requires a profound, almost uncomfortable level of trust between the buyer and the broker. And once a shortlist is compiled from these digital tours, the buyer executes a surgical, highly targeted 2 to 3 day fly-in.
An absolute blitz.
Yeah.
They fly in on a Thursday night, spend Friday and Saturday looking at 6 to 8 carefully vetted, pre-selected homes, and fly back to Florida on Sunday to make a massive financial decision.
And when it comes time to write the contract, the actual mechanics of the purchase hold some major culture shocks for Floridians.
Okay, like what?
First, there is the matter of earnest money. In Washington, the expectation is typically 1% to 3% of the purchase price. So on a median home, you are wiring anywhere from $6,750 to over $20,000 within a few days just to hold the contract.
Wow, okay. But the biggest whiplash, according to the text, is the inspection process. It completely flips the script on what you are actually afraid of.
This is a fascinating localized detail that really highlights the environmental differences. In Florida, home inspections are entirely driven by the insurance market's terror of catastrophic wind events and flooding.
Right.
You are doing wind mitigation reports to check how the roof is strapped to the walls. You are doing four-point inspections. You are obsessing over FEMA flood zone maps and elevation certificates.
But in Washington, the guide explicitly says almost none of that matters. The threats to the structure are completely inverted by the climate.
Exactly.
Instead, you are looking for things that sound totally alien to a Floridian buyer. Because it drizzles for 9 months out of the year, the number one enemy is moisture intrusion. You are checking for black mold. You are checking drainage slopes around the foundation. You are looking at French drains.
And because Washington hasn't had its housing stock cyclically leveled and rebuilt by hurricanes every 20 years, the houses are significantly older.
Oh, that makes sense.
So you are inspecting 100-year-old infrastructure that is still hiding in the walls. You are looking for knob and tube electrical wiring, which is an archaic, ungrounded system. Or you are looking for degrading galvanized plumbing that will eventually fail.
It's completely different vocabulary of risk. But once you clear those inspections, thanks to our digital infrastructure, the actual closing is completely anticlimactic.
Yeah, it's pretty seamless now.
You don't have to fly back. DocuSign and mobile notaries who come to your house in Florida handle the massive stack of paperwork, while the county recorders and title companies transfer the asset on the West Coast.
The ink is dry, the moving trucks arrive, the equity is transferred, which brings us to the final, most human element of this entire process, landing pads.
Where do they go?
Right. Where exactly are these Florida expats landing in Bellingham, and what does the community actually feel like once the dust settles and the moving boxes are unpacked?
The broker does something incredibly clever here. He maps specific Bellingham neighborhoods to their direct Florida cultural equivalents. It is an incredibly effective translation matrix for an outsider trying to understand a new city. Let's walk through these landing pads.
Sounds good. First up is Fairhaven. This is the historic, walkable, brick-paved village at the south end of the city, right on the water. Homes here carry a massive premium. Expect to pay anywhere from $700,000 to well over $1.1 million.
The guide matches Fairhaven directly to buyers coming from Miami or perhaps downtown Orlando, who are desperately seeking a walkable urban-like core. They want independent bookstores, high-end coffee shops, a vibrant restaurant scene in the Alaska ferry terminal right outside their door.
It's a lifestyle choice.
Yeah. If you want aesthetic charm and walkability, this is the bullseye, but you pay dearly for it.
Next, you have Edgemoor, located in the southwest corner of Bellingham. It's also in that premium $700,000 to $1.1 million range. It features sprawling mid-century homes, large private lots, mature towering trees, and very quiet meandering streets situated above the bay.
The guide says Edgemoor is the absolute perfect match for Florida expats who are used to those massive, insular, gated communities or large lot suburbs in places like Boca Raton or Naples.
Very accurate comparison.
It gives them the extreme privacy, the quiet, and the physical space they expect. But instead of stucco and palm trees, it's cedar siding and giant Pacific Northwest evergreens.
For a more traditional, middle-class suburban feel, there is Barclay. Priced between $550,000 and $750,000, it offers newer construction seamlessly mixed with 1990s builds. The broker explicitly notes that buyers coming from the sprawling Orlando suburbs, or areas like Wesley Chapel outside of Tampa, places entirely defined by master-planned communities, wide roads, and easy access to shopping centers, will recognize the rhythm of Barclay immediately. It feels familiar and functional.
If you want to be near the university energy, there's Sehome. It sits in the $580,000 to $750,000 range. It's highly walkable, heavily treed, right near Western Washington University, and naturally attracts younger professional families and academics.
It's a great spot.
And then there is South Hill, which ranges from $500,000 to $700,000. It's located near Whatcom Falls Park, which sounds absolutely gorgeous and acts as a really solid, more affordable entry point to the city proper without paying that massive Fairhaven premium.
And importantly, the guide delivers completely neutral demographic data regarding the rural options for those who want actual acreage or waterfront property without being in the city limits.
Okay, like where?
Areas like Ferndale, which offers more affordable suburban sprawl, or Linden, which is situated near the Canadian border and has a very strong traditional conservative Dutch agricultural heritage. And Birch Bay, which offers genuine walkable waterfront living without the catastrophic storm risk of the Florida coast.
Okay, so you have found your neighborhood, you bought the house. If you were moving with a family, what about the schools? This is a massive anxiety point for migrating parents.
The educational philosophy in the Pacific Northwest represents a significant cultural shift. Bellingham Public Schools, which serves roughly 11,000 students, focuses heavily on project-based learning, inquiry, student well-being, and the arts.
This is a stark, almost jarring contrast to the Florida system. The guide notes that the culture up there leans entirely away from the heavy, high-stakes, standardized testing regimes that dominate Florida, like the FSA tests.
Right.
It's a completely different educational pacing and metric for success.
And speaking of pacing, we have to talk about the traffic, or rather the glorious lack of it.
Yes. The geographic friction of daily life practically evaporates. The guide notes that a bad commute in Bellingham is getting stuck behind two red lights and taking 15 minutes to cross town.
It's a dream.
You are permanently trading the relentless white-knuckle, bumper-to-bumper crawl of I-4 in Orlando or I-95 in Miami for an environment where you can cross the entire city in a fraction of the time. It fundamentally reorganizes your entire sense of time and what you can actually accomplish in a single day.
But the guide is honest that the transition isn't perfectly smooth. There is real cultural friction. It talks extensively about the social and culinary adjustments, and it specifically highlights the infamous Seattle Freeze. Ah, yes. The Seattle Freeze is a very real sociological phenomenon. The social texture of the Pacific Northwest famously runs much cooler upon initial contact than the transplant-heavy, instantaneous openness of Florida.
Explain the mechanism behind that, though. Why are they so different?
It comes down to transience versus rootedness. Florida is a state built on constant migration. Everyone is from somewhere else. So forced friendliness is a survival mechanism to build fast networks.
Right.
Washington, specifically outside of Seattle, has deeper, more established roots. People are incredibly polite. They will help you shovel your driveway, but they are reserved. They already have their friend groups from high school or college. The guide warns that it often takes 6 to 12 months of consistently showing up to the same cafe or joining a local recreation league to break through that initial frost and form deep connections.
You have to put in the reps. And the food. I love how brutally honest the broker is here, because food is such an emotional part of where we live.
Oh, absolutely.
You are going to lose the Cuban coffee. You are going to lose the stone crab. You are leaving behind the top-tier Latin and Caribbean food that South Florida arguably does better than anywhere else in the entire country. If you want authentic pastelitos, you are out of luck.
But in return, you gain an entirely new, deeply regional palate. You tap into the deeply entrenched Pacific Northwest craft coffee culture, access to fresh local oysters, wild-caught salmon, and a massive world-class craft beer scene featuring iconic local breweries like Culshan and Boundary Bay.
It's exactly as the guide frames it. It is not better or worse. It is just a complete palate and social reset. You just have to let it be its own thing rather than endlessly wishing it was Miami with mountains.
Which brings us to the ultimate synthesis of this entire discussion. If we extract the core undeniable truth from this 2026 relocation guide, it is this.
Okay, lay it on me.
The pipeline from Florida to Bellingham, Washington is not some whimsical, spontaneous adventure driven by a desire for a change of scenery. It is a highly calculated, deeply pragmatic trade.
It is trading intense, inescapable summer heat, the grinding psychological stress of hurricane season, and absolutely crushing, wealth-destroying insurance premiums.
Yes.
For gray, drizzly winters, higher gas prices at the pump, and profound long-term financial and physical peace of mind.
It is the ultimate exercise in choosing your heart. You have to decide which set of challenges you are best equipped to endure. And as we conclude, this data leaves us with a much larger, frankly provocative question to ponder about the future of the American map.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this the entire time we've been talking.
Oh, yeah.
If the insurance crisis is literally forcing everyday people, retirees, and middle-class families to abandon the Sun Belt, if they can no longer afford the carrying cost to live in Tampa or Miami,
right,
who exactly is buying the properties they leave behind?
It's a great question.
Are we looking at a rapidly approaching future where the entire American Sun Belt, these highly desirable but deeply uninsurable coastal zones, is exclusively owned by massive private equity firms and hedge funds? I mean, think about it. Entities that have so much capital they can afford to self-insure against the hurricanes, slowly turning the entire state of Florida into an exclusive corporate-owned renter's paradise.
It is a chilling, entirely plausible scenario.
Yep.
The transfer of wealth currently happening under the guise of climate risk is quietly restructuring the foundation of American homeownership.
It really is. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the numbers behind the narratives, and we will see you next time.